I'd like to call this meeting to order. Welcome to the meeting of the Research and Innovation Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee. The meeting is called to order. Mrs. Wright, would you please call the roll?
Vice Committee Chair Rita Athes.
Here.
Trustee Dennis Barsima.
Here.
Trustee John Butler.
Here.
Trustee Veronica Herrero. Trustee Aidan O'Brien.
Here.
Trustee Leland Strum.
Here.
Committee Chair Eric Wasowitz.
Here.
Board Chair Montel Gales.
Here.
Thank you.
Mr. Perry, would you please confirm that the appropriate notice of this meeting has been provided and that we have a quorum present?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. You have a quorum present. An appropriate notice has been provided pursuant to the Illinois Open Meetings Act.
May I have a motion to approve the agenda as proposed?
So move, Gales.
Second, Butler.
We have a motion and we have a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. May I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So made, Strum.
Second, Barsima.
So we have a motion, we have a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. So this is the time for chairs, comments, and announcements. John Accardo, nice tie. Like that. That's good stuff. So just want to make sure you're paying attention. So the since I joined the board, I learned that we are a research university. Which is amazing that I didn't know that. I thought it was the best kept secret, and over time I've become more and more impressed with the research work that we do on a daily basis. I suggest to everyone that we look for the updates being sent out by our research area. They're extremely informative, and I look forward to seeing more, and I look forward to hearing more from Vice President Makarski today about our strategies for research, artistry, and innovation. I want to welcome any University Advisory Committee representatives present today. Do you have any comments?
No comments today.
Okay. We recognize members of the public who have complied with state law and Board of Trustees bylaws by registering their written request to address the board with our parliamentarian. Mr. Perry, you're the parliamentarian. Have you received any timely request to address this meeting?
Mr. Chair, we have no public comment this morning.
Okay. At this point, I'd like to ask Vice President for Research and Innovation Partnerships, Richard Makarski, for news items and comments.
Thank you. I want to take just a brief moment to go over the Research and Innovation Partnerships mission, vision, values. Really proud of our leadership team building off the amazing work that's been doing as the board chair Wasowitz said, for years, we have a very strong research culture, and we are looking to enhance and continue to build upon what's already been laid with our amazing faculty. So next slide, please. Just briefly want to go over what we've done this summer to develop our values, our mission and vision for the unit so that we can be a service organization where our product is faculty success and therefore our customers are mainly faculty and students and we are here to serve them. And first, our values are to be nurturing, resourceful, ethical, partners, accessible, joyous, and change agents. Next slide, please. This leads into our vision. And our vision is based in the university goals, goals 5 and I believe it's 3B. 3B, yeah. To grow the research and creative enterprise to empower world-transforming discovery, paradigm-shifting expression, and life-changing student opportunities. As you heard in the last meeting, I'm one of those students who had that life-changing student opportunity. I wouldn't be here if I didn't have an opportunity to work with faculty directly, and we do that so well here. And this vision is to continue to foster that culture. Next slide, please. Our mission, to be more focused, is to create that ecosystem for thriving and growing research and creative enterprise. And you'll see over the coming months, it's implementing things that have already been done, enhancing things to meet the needs of today, this changing landscape that's out there. Next slide. And this has led to 5 strategic goals for the year. Next slide. Our first is to grow research, artistry, and innovation. And when I talk about growth, it's not just growth in dollars, that's important, but it's also growth in impact, right? We want to provide those platforms and match faculty to resources so that they can get their voice out and their work can impact the world. Next slide. We want to develop and expand partnerships internal and externally. So you'll see our team out and about. We are doing as much as we can to connect with industry, government, et cetera, but also internally, trying to break silos down and help the sort of pockets of excellence work together. They already are doing that. It's just continuing to build those bridges. Next slide, please. We are going to nurture our entrepreneurial mindset. And what that means is create that safety net for risk-taking. I mentioned in the last report, we have extremely high success rates, which means I want to push our faculty to take bigger swings, maybe have a lower success rate, but go for larger grants so they can have greater impact. Some of our faculty are doing this already. We're just going to continue to push that and provide this sort of backing so they can have that ability to take those risks. Next slide. We're going to improve our operational effectiveness. The leadership team, I see a number of them here, and I are working to make sure we have compliant processes, but that are still not barriers to entry. Next slide. And finally, we want to increase the brand awareness. As Committee Chair Wasowitz said, we don't want research and artistry to be the best kept secret anymore. We want to be loud and proud, both internally and externally. And that's it. I'll turn it back over to the committee chair. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Does anybody have any questions or thoughts? Trustee Athus?
I just wanted, well, first of all, thank you for the presentation. In the beginning, you talked about, I'm trying to remember how you listed it, but I thought it was really interesting that you put joyous on there when you talked about the students. And I wanted to, have you explain a little bit about what you meant about that, because it's not something that you usually see on an act. I was very pleased to see it, but not something that you usually see. And what does that mean to you to have a joyous cohort or student body? Or
well, and it's our staff, the students, the faculty, mm-hmm. recognizing, taking the time to recognize the impact that we're having can be a joyful experience, mm-hmm. and enjoying the work and the process. Right. One of the great things about research and artistry is that it's an opportunity to fail. And that we need to make sure we don't get down on ourselves for failing. If we're not failing, we're asking the wrong questions, right? Because then we're not taking, if you already know the answer to the research question, you're doing something wrong. So the research process is a place to learn how to take the lumps and move forward and do it the hard way, right? As we say, and we should embrace the process, and that's where we want to see that joy coming in. And we want to celebrate our wins and successes. We want to make sure our students who are participating in the research enterprise feel like they know how valuable they are to that enterprise. We want to make sure our faculty know how valuable they are to changing the world, right? As we said, world-changing discovery. So that's what we mean by that joy, and I want our staff to reflect that. A lot of the work our staff does, whether it's in research compliance or sponsored programs or innovation, is technical, right? They might be filing a patent or they might be looking at a human subjects thing, and it can feel just like paperwork. Well, if we can connect that paperwork to the outcomes, we can feel pride in that, and that to me brings joy.
All right, thank you. Appreciate that inclusion.
Erica.
Yes.
Thank you, likewise, for the brief presentation on that. On the external partnerships part, the DeKalb area in this northeast Illinois region is in an interesting spot right now. There's a lot of activity and focus and growth going on in this area. There's a lot of companies that have already arrived. There's a lot that are looking to settle in this area because of our geographic and strategic locations. The relationships that are built in this, and I'm curious on your goals and the plan for this strategic outreach with these external partners, because that's going to play a big part in the success here, I think, at the university as well.
Thank you for that question. And I view us as a connector along with many of the folks on the senior leadership team. We have a senior strategic development team that includes advancement, includes OERD, includes academic affairs. And all of those, as well as others, are really important to that connection, including the colleges and the deans as well, right? And I think it's a whole systems approach. We can't just go into, I want to meet with Company X because they have a research opportunity and view it through that narrow lens. It needs to be a broader conversation about, are there opportunities for student training programs, pipeline programs, those kinds of things, and bring in student affairs and academic affairs and make sure we're talking. So if you think about it from the different units on campus, we're coordinating. And we're just one piece of that. And sometimes our piece is a support piece. And here's the things we can add value to a relationship. But sometimes we're the lead piece as well, okay? We have smaller corporations that need help or smaller nonprofits that need help with things they can't do in-house in terms of research. Do we have a faculty member and a student team that could do this in an efficient way for them to help them achieve their goals while also achieving the faculty's goals?
Because I guess I can't stress enough in what I see and hear and in business dealings and others, that the future of this region, and I'm talking about the corridor from the Fox River Valley out to DeKalb here, is going to see, I think, in the next decade or two, tremendous growth. You look at areas of the country where you've had a research development in universities around areas of business development and growth. It's going to be a unique time for NIU, and I hope that we are prepared appropriately to communicate, to engage, and to establish these working relationships at an early phase, because it takes that culture of working, of understanding and working from the outset of this to really secure long-term relationships.
I appreciate that, and I agree wholeheartedly. And we're going to do everything we can to be strategic and deploy to build those partnerships. And we want to be there at the ground floor. And I'm very pleased to see what's already been happening and what's already in place and the plans moving forward. The engagement seems to be stepping up for exactly the reasons you're talking about. I think that economic development is going to explode, and it makes sense given our geographical location.
I wholeheartedly support Richard's answer, but I see two of our most externally active deans are here in the audience with us, Dean Gruhl from the College of Engineering and Engineering Technology and Dean Phillips Hernandez from the College of Business. And I just want to compliment the way that our deans collaborate with the Division of Outreach, with the Research Office, with Corporate and Foundation Relations. I've been at a number of universities where we had very strong regional economic development connections, and we would see sometimes the deans, particularly of those two colleges, trying to hoard relationships or elbow others out. And that is just not what we do within the Husky family. And I could sit here, and I won't, because I know we don't want you to lose to John Butler as the most efficient chair. But I could just rattle off so many companies and so many community-based organizations where we have multiple points in, and we're communicating well as a university, so we're not exhibiting a left-hand, right-hand problem to our partners. And I'm very proud of the way we work together across the academic and executive leadership.
Any other thoughts? Trustee Butler, huh?
Now I get it, okay. Go ahead.
I swear I'm not trying to sabotage you, but you can't come close to the last meeting.
Sorry.
I wonder if you could help the committee appreciate when we talk about sort of the joyousness of this, right? So if you're a new faculty member and you come to Northern fresh out of your PhD and you're in a tenure track role, you've got a sponsored programs operation where that new faculty member can take their research goals and aspirations and bring it to someone and say, what's out there that might help me do the work that I'm doing and make this the place where I launch my first book or I create a new program that hasn't existed prior. And I look at the sponsored program's webpage and I know from my own past experience there are particular people that new faculty member can go to and begin a conversation, and that's really where the joyousness happens, right? Like that's where you realize that you're doing things that people are interested in and you begin to learn what sort of resources might be out there for you. And then you also have somebody that's helping you produce a proposal, which is really critical because the last proposal you might have created was for your dissertation, but that's not necessarily, that's for a very specialized academic audience. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about that process and how you select people to work in that operation who can work with faculty members on their research agendas.
Thank you for that. And I appreciate you pointing out the hard work of the division. And so AVP Little is in the audience as well as Director of Research Development Kelly Drislin, and they're linchpins of this. And actually that what we didn't get into the details, but behind those strategic goals are some organizational shifts to more clearly articulate those points of entry for different faculties. So research development is morphing into a more high-touch unit where their goal is to work directly with faculty on trajectory planning and on proposal development before it gets to sponsored programs for the submission. We've seen a significant increase in sponsored programs activity over the last 10 years, but even last 5 years, and the complexity has increased as well from the federal regulation side, so that side of the house can't do it all anymore and be that. They still build relationships with faculty, but the sort of 6 months out, let's talk about what your proposal looks like in the shape. So research development's coming into that space, and we're hoping by early January to have that reorganization in place where we're launching it out to faculty to have those one-on-one connections. And the other thing is we want to make sure our faculty who come in recognize the power of the faculty who are already here. Don't want to share too much here on the data, but maybe in the future we can look at some of the weighted citation impacts. And we, on a per publication, per faculty metric, look more like the University of Illinois than we do Carbondale or ISU, right? So, and we are at the top of the MAC in that as well. And I can share that data later next meeting maybe to show just how impactful our faculty are. And that's a really important point of contact too, because it's a whole sort of village mentality.
Right, absolutely. Well, I would invite learning more about that because it gets into sort of the proof, not promises, on this notion of what it means to be a research institution, and gives us some things that we can talk about when we're trying to explain to people what's happening here and why it's exceptional. So,
looking forward to that.
Thanks. Anyone else?
Sure.
I have to point this out. We look more like the University of Illinois in terms of the excellence and productivity of our faculty, and we do that with undergraduates engaged at every level of the research enterprise rather than postdocs or graduate students, and that's something that distinguishes us from the competition.
Spoken like somebody that was here 10 years ago running the research program, so.
I think I was provost 10 years ago.
You may have been. Well, thank you. I think that's all really good stuff. And I just hope, you know, the public understands what's going on here, is that we have a strategy. There's a plan that's going on here. So we'll hear more in our next meeting about goals for the university. We've just reviewed the president on her goals from last year. We have future goals coming up. There's a plan here. We're just not making this up as we go along. And there's a long-term vision here, and it all ties together. So research and innovation being a part of that. So thank you, Richard, for that. No one else has anything else, any thoughts? We'll move on then to agenda item 7A, the state legislative report. Katie, is Katie in virtually here, or can we pull? There she is. Hey, Katie. How are you?
Good morning. Hello. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to join virtually today. Unlike the federal elections, the state elections did not see much substantial changes. Democrats in Illinois have retained their supermajority in the legislature. The 76th district race, which includes the district representing NIU, however, remains too close to call. As of this morning, Democrat candidate Murray Burrell is leading Republican candidate Liz Bishop by approximately 500 votes, though a significant number of mail-in ballots have yet to be counted, which could impact the outcome. Veto session is scheduled to begin in Springfield next week, though it's unclear whether any bills will, with implications for higher education, will be moved forward. However, we're prepared to address any outstanding bills from last year's spring session. As previously reported, Senate Bill 3965, also known as the Funding Formula Bill, seeks to overhaul the approach to higher education funding in Illinois. This bill is a product of the Illinois Board of Higher Education's Commission on Equitable Public University Funding, and the commission's findings highlighted a substantial underfunding of universities and proposes a formula that considers adequate funding levels for public universities. President Freeman has participated in a number of the negotiation sessions that have been held by the bill's sponsors and continues to participate in those. In fact, we're having another one next week here in Springfield, and she can obviously address any questions regarding those discussions. But I will yield my time because I think the federal relations report may have more than what I do this time.
Are there any questions for Katie? Trustee Butler? Yeah.
So does this mean that 3965 is, and excuse my lack of understanding here, but does this mean that the hope is to pass this through the veto session?
That is still unclear. I think those of us who have been engaged in the conversations recognize that passing a bill like this during veto session would be very challenging for them. It's not completely off the table, though. Anything can happen. We've seen greater things passed in veto session, including the Legislative Black Caucus passed a huge omnibus bill during a veto session a few years ago. So we're not considering that. However, most of the conversations that we've had suggest that this will come during spring session.
How financially binding is this legislation? Let's say that it passed in the veto session. Is there an argument that it's simply an advisory measure that should inform the budgetary process, or?
I think you can look at this bill as parallel to the EBF formula for K-12 that it's modeled against. So it will identify a formula that will be used going forward. The nature and the exact details of that formula is still under negotiations. It will identify an overall funding goal. But it will not bind the legislature to, or the General Assembly, to a timeline for achieving adequate funding. It will have an overall number, and it will have provisions in it for guardrails, for what will be done in the event that funding is not added, but rather subtracted from the overall higher ed appropriation. There is nothing in the bill currently that binds the bill to keep pace with inflation. So I'm not exactly sure what you're asking, but there's certainly no guarantee that the billions of dollars we need to adequately fund higher ed in Illinois will be forthcoming on any timeline as a result of the legislation. But it does shine a spotlight on the historic disinvestment in public higher education, the fact that none of our institutions of public higher education are adequately funded to meet the needs of their students, and that some are more inadequately funded than others. Mm-hmm. In addition to the negotiation sessions that Katie described, there have been four already, and you know, as she said, there's one next week in Springfield, and I don't think that's the last one. There have also been listening sessions that have been scheduled around the state. Those have been convened by the advocacy groups that have been represented on the commission and now in the negotiations. Organizations like the Partnership for College Completion and Advance Illinois and Women Employed. And those have been, we had one here at NIU just about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago. It's an overview of the bill and an opportunity to gather feedback from stakeholders from across the community who register and come to the sessions. And I thought our community was very, very well represented at the session that we held here. So I'm very proud of Huskies for showing up, Huskies faculty, students, staff, and alumni.
Can you help me understand a negotiation session in the context of state public policy? Is it like a hearing, or who's in charge?
The bill's co-sponsors are in charge, Leader Lightford and Representative Ammons.
Dennis.
So with this bill, is it the intention of this bill to replace the process we go through today relative to appropriation requests that we make to the IBAG, which we're in the process of doing as we speak?
Yes and no. So there is conversation going on about the value of keeping public hearings as part of the new process, but the actual appropriation would be more formulaic under this bill. You know, right now we don't really have a funding formula for higher education. We have a legacy way we've always done it, and a political process by which we ask for increments and receive what's given, and everything is generally awarded across the board to the universities. And one of the revelations that was maybe not surprising to the university presidents, but surprising to some others, is that the universities have evolved over time in terms of the number of students they serve, their missions, and the characteristics of the students they serve. And so the legacy way of appropriating funds is really doing a very poor job of serving our state, serving our workforce, and serving our students. And so in that sense, having a rational basis that we can agree upon will be a big improvement. But part of the negotiations right now are sort of the details of what that formula will look like, and also how the way we've always done it will intersect with the way we're going to do it in terms of maintaining the role of the IBHE as an oversight or distribution mechanism, the nature of the testimony of the presidents, whether or not we'll get relief from the very large set of forms that we submit to the legislature every year in preparation for appropriations in the new context.
So I understand the negotiations that are taking place and the different meetings that are going on, which you and others are a part of. Who at the end of the day makes the decision on the formula? Is that the co-sponsors or the legislature?
Certainly, the co-sponsors will determine the nature of the bill that's introduced into the General Assembly, but this will go through a legislative process. So the negotiations now are to resolve differences of opinion that grew out of the Funding Commission report that were not resolved at that time. The Funding Commission report left a number of key questions unanswered. A choice was made to take one option and put it into the bill. but the decision has to be made which option goes forward to the General Assembly for further debate and consideration. In addition, as with any legislation, when you put recommendations that come out of a task force into a bill, into legislative language, you start to worry about where the commas are, you start to worry about intersections with other processes, and so those very technical issues are also being resolved in the negotiation process. But the things that are subjects of respectful disagreement now are probably not the only things that will be subjects of respectful disagreement as we go forward to a broader audience in the General Assembly. So basically, there's a lot of work to be done before final legislation is considered in the General Assembly. I don't know, Matt or Katie, if you want to add anything about the legislative process.
No, and I think, other than I think you're just laying out why once it hits the legislature, it is going to have a significant amount of dialogue discussion around it.
And there's this is also a year where the speaker has not a very high level of enthusiasm for a complicated veto session. So,
thank you. Anyone else? Any thoughts? Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
Have a good day. So moving on to agenda item 7B, the Federal Relations Report, is Julia Rowe. Hey, Julia. How is D.C. these days?
It's well. I'm going to get into the items in my written report and then the election results. The Department of Education has begun beta testing on the 25-26 FAFSA form, and it's the form is scheduled to be available to all students starting on December 1st.
Wow.
And the Department of Education has announced that they would delay the reporting deadline for the financial value transparency and gainful employment regulations until January 15th, 2025. So moving to election results, as we all know, former President Trump and Senator J.D. Vance have won the presidential election with 51% of the popular vote and 295 electoral votes as of this morning. In the coming days and weeks, the Trump transition team will be established, and then we will get a better picture of what the second-term Trump administration priorities will be. Looking to the 119th Congress, which begins on January 3rd of next year, control of the House of Representatives is still to be determined. There are 38 seats that have yet to be called as of this morning. Currently, Republicans have picked up one seat to control 206 seats, and Democrats control 181. We need 218 to have control of the chamber. Looking at the Senate, we'll be controlled by Republicans. We currently hold 52 seats, and Democrats with 44. There are four races still to be called in the Senate in Maine, Arizona, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. In January, Senate Republicans will hold elections for a new leader as Senator Mitch McConnell has stepped down as majority leader in the Senate. For the Illinois House races, we have 17 members of the Illinois congressional delegation. All of our races have been called and all of our candidates have won, so no changes in our House delegation. And that's my update.
Any questions for Julia? I think it's probably still too early to see where that is. It will be an interesting meeting when we reconvene in February. So if there aren't any other questions, we will move along. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you.
So agenda item 7C, sponsored program administrative quarterly report. Dara Little has a written report that we can see, or if anybody has any questions along that at all. We have no questions on that. So with that, we'll move on to agenda item 7D. I'll never be able to catch John Butler, but I'm moving right along here. Faculty presentation. Lindsay Harris. Hey, Lindsay.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
The mic is yours.
All right. Okay, I wanted to check because I heard Dr. Makarski saying advanced slide, and I was wondering if I would need to do that as well, and it looks like I do. Okay. Who is advancing my slides?
Liz Wright, who's sitting remotely.
Thank you, yeah. Okay.
Just say you want it advanced, and
okay,
we'll figure it out.
All right, well, thank you for having me today. I'll introduce myself in a second, but first, if you'll advance the slide, I would like to give a brief outline of my presentation. I'll talk about how I got here, key features of the two grants that I currently have from the NIH, talk about the details of our project, how students have been involved and the feedback we're getting from them, and next steps. And Liz, I have some animations in my slide, so you might just need to use your judgment to advance the bullet points as I go through them. Advance slide. So how did I get here? I started my career as a high school English teacher in New York City in a public school in the South Bronx. Click. That's me standing in front of my school probably in around 2007. I was an English teacher. I wanted to teach Shakespeare. And I became very frustrated that my students couldn't read at a level that had allowed us to really have the conversations I was hoping for. So I left to pursue a PhD in the cognitive and neural foundations of reading. And then when I was looking for a faculty position, I really wanted to work with a student population like the one that I had really loved in New York. I also wanted to work at a place where I could do research that students could be involved in addition to teaching, and NIU was a really great fit for that. So if you want to click, click, click. I'm currently an associate professor in educational psychology in the LEPF department. I am the co-director of our Center for the Interdisciplinary Study of Language and Literacy here at NIU. And my research lab is called the Penn Lab, which stands for Psycholinguistics in Education at Northern. Next slide. So I'm here to talk about my current research project. I'm in the second year of a four-year NIH project. Click. I also, this year, was awarded a diversity supplement in addition to that original grant, which amounts to $109,000 approximately. This is NIU's first R16 grant. I'll explain that more about what that means in a minute. And it's the largest research grant awarded to the university in quite some time, I've been told. So continue. I'll talk a little bit more about the details of those two grant mechanisms that are funding me. Next slide. So the R16 is also known as a SURE grant. And the SURE program at the NIH is intended for institutions like NIU that both have a lot of students from underrepresented backgrounds and that receive limited NIH research project funding. I have a type of SURE grant called the SURE First Award, which is specifically intended for faculty who have not had prior external research funding, which was the case with me when I applied for this grant. Next slide. I also mentioned I have a diversity supplement. So the NIH allows principal investigators, PIs of grants, once they've been awarded a grant, to apply for additional funding to hire a student from an underrepresented background in biomedical health-related research to join the team. And I had a candidate that you'll learn more about in a minute that was just fantastic, and so last year I applied for a diversity supplement for him to join us. Next slide. So what is this project I keep talking about? Go ahead. So the name of the project is Word Learning and Vocabulary Development in Blind Children, and it's worth pausing a second to explain the terminology I'm using. So I'm saying blind children first because our participants have no more than light perception. They're either totally blind or can perceive light, but no more. So the term visually impaired would often refer to people that have maybe low vision or a wider range of disabilities. Additionally, there's a very active debate as to the appropriate terminology for talking about people with disabilities / disabled people. Some people prefer person first language, which would be children who are blind. Other people prefer identity first, blind children. I tend to go back and forth between the two. So that's what I'll be doing today. Next bullet. So the area of language and cognition in blindness is a really potentially fruitful area for understanding both language and cognition in sighted people, but also for helping a population that has been really ignored by research for a long time. And there's a lot to learn here. However, right now there are only 4 labs in the country, to my knowledge, that are doing this work. There's one at Rice, one at Harvard, one at Johns Hopkins, and our lab here at NIU. So we're excited to be involved in the cutting edge of research there. Next bullet. As I mentioned, I am a reading researcher. So I became interested in this subject because there is a substantial reading achievement gap between blind and sighted children. We can argue about whether there should be any gap, how big that gap should be. I don't think it needs to be 4 years, which is what it currently is. So, next bullet. We know that substantial vocabulary is really important to support reading comprehension, and bullet. Sighted children rely heavily on vision in building their vocabularies. However, bullet, not much is known about how and when blind children acquire vocabulary words. Very little, in fact. Next slide. And so we have 3 aims for this study. Go ahead and put those up. The first one is to determine whether vocabulary development in blind children is delayed relative to sighted children. Just that question, which seems so obvious, is not known. That's how little research there is in this area. We're also going to examine whether the way blind children learn words is the same that sighted children learn words, and create a set of norms that can be used for future research by other researchers and by education and clinical professionals. And I can talk more about those if you're interested. Next slide. How will we do this? Well, this is excerpted directly from our grant application. To accomplish our objectives, we will question hundreds of blind and sighted children ages 5 through 14 about the definition of dozens of words. NIU students will participate in all phases of the research, and our research team's expertise in cognitive development, word learning, developmental disabilities uniquely positions us to carry out this project. That is all true. So if you'll go to the next slide. I'd like to talk about our amazing team. You've met me, Lindsay Harris. I'm from educational psychology. And this is a really complex problem that required a really interdisciplinary team from across campus and other universities to tackle. So the other faculty on the grant are Allison Gladfelter from speech-language pathology here at NIU, Molly Pasley from our nationally and internationally renowned visual disabilities program here at NIU, and Rebecca Treeman from Washington University in St. Louis. The SureFirst program requires the PI to have a research mentor, and I was very lucky to get Rebecca Treeman to agree to be my mentor on this project. She's fantastic. So, next slide. We also have a very substantial, healthy team of students working with us. So on the left there is Brad Blair. He was the first GA that I hired to work on this project. In addition to being a PhD student in educational psychology, he is a lifelong blind person and braille reader and has a previous doctorate in linguistics. So he was very well suited to this project. In the middle is Tremaine Love, who is also a PhD student in educational psychology, and he started volunteering his time on the grant last year because he was looking for a dissertation project. He was interested in what I was doing, and he was so fantastic that he is the person that I applied for the diversity supplement in order to be able to pay him for all of his hard work on the project. And finally, on the right there is Don Soto, another PhD student ed psych, who she's not currently being paid. She's also volunteering her time because she is interested in this research. She's looking for ways to collect data for her dissertation, and so that's how she got involved. We also have a lot of undergrads working with us. They are all communicative disorders majors here on campus because research experience like this is very important for their career development as they prepare to apply for speech-language pathology graduate programs. And it's worth noting that of the five students working with us this year, three of them are Hispanic or Latina versus nationwide, approximately 5% of SLPs are Hispanic or Latina. So it really speaks to the diversity of our undergraduate research that our undergraduate population that without trying per se, we ended up with such a diverse undergraduate team. Next slide. So how are our students involved? Next slide. So the grad students have been busy writing. Go one more click. Those are the 12 manuscripts that we are planning to produce as a result of this four-year project. And one more click. Nine of them will be first authored by these three students as part of their dissertation or just as part of their graduate experience here at NIU. So they have been really busy writing, and in fact, over the past few months have actually written the introductions and methods sections of those nine manuscripts. We're attempting to get acceptance in principle from journals before we begin collecting data. Next slide. So you remember we have all of these undergraduates working with us. You're gonna have to click a few times here. So first, what are they doing? They are helping us make our surveys that we're administering to parents of our participants. And I don't know if you're able to see, but they've actually translated the surveys into Spanish for us because three of our undergrads are bilingual English-Spanish speakers. So that's something they've been involved with. Next, they've been helping us make recruitment materials to put on social media and elsewhere. Next, also doing that in Spanish. Next, they have been helping us design the list of words that we're going to be asking our participants about, which is actually a fairly complex process in itself that I can take questions on if you're interested. Next. And they've been helping us collect pilot data. So this is a pilot session with one of my daughters, actually, from last spring, who participated as a guinea pig in the early phases of this project. They will also, all of our students will be involved in collecting data moving forward as well. Next. So to find out what their experiences of working on the project have been, we administered an anonymous survey. And they all reported that they would recommend working on research to their friends, that they enjoyed working on the grant a great deal or a lot, and that they thought the working on the grant would help them be more effective at their future jobs. And on the next slide, I just put a few quotes from the open-ended questions on the survey to give you a sense of what they're getting out of this project. So if you want to advance to the next slide, I just will mention a couple of our next steps. So this year, this semester, like I said, we're going to obtain acceptance in principle from journals for those manuscripts. We're involved in our second rounds of methods piloting. We're setting up our data management software system to help us run all our data. And in the spring, we will recruit participants and start collecting data. Longer term, I feel like I'm well positioned, or at least better positioned, for future funding than I was before this project. I have a lot of ideas, including a bunch of questions that we could answer with the data from this grant, that I could write more grant proposals to answer. There's also new technology that it's revolutionary in this field that tracks finger movements while reading. Currently, that device I'm holding in that picture, I believe we are the only university in the world to have one of those right now. So that is going to be really exciting to work with. I'm also really interested in the question of dyslexia in Braille readers, which something else that we know very little about. So that's me. I believe the next slide says questions. Yep. So I'm very happy to take questions if anybody has any.
Montel?
Great presentation.
Thank you.
You did an excellent job. It raised a lot of questions with me in terms of how you get your participants. I noticed that one of the slides showed the social outreach or social media outreach. Is that how you get the kids?
So we've been, is it possible, I put some extra slides up in case I had this question. Is it possible to go back to the slides or no? So we have, if you go to a slide that says community partnerships, there. So we've spent the last year forming partnerships with a bunch of different organizations, including the American Printing House for the Blind and the Association for Education and Rehabilitation of the Blind and Visually Impaired, who have a vested interest in this research as well, and they're going to disseminate our recruitment materials to people in their networks. We also have an advisory board that includes a parent of two blind children, an SLP at the Illinois School for the Visually Impaired, a blind bilingual PhD student at University of Illinois, the director of outreach at the Wisconsin Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, someone from the American Printing House for the Blind, a researcher at Rice. So all of these people also have their own networks of children in the blind community who are going to help disseminate that for us. In addition, I mentioned there's a lab at Harvard that's doing research in this area, and I met with the PI there, and she said she's willing and happy to spread the word for us, in addition to sharing a couple strategies that they've used in the past, which are there are certain hashtags in social media that parents of children who are blind tend to use, like blind baby and things like that, that we're going to be using in order to hopefully reach more of those people.
And then the other questions are just more anecdotal in nature. Are these kids coming from families that also have these disabilities? Are they all from the same sort of cultural backgrounds or economic backgrounds?
Great question. Okay, so first, this is probably doesn't need saying, but blindness can affect anyone. So the blind population in the United States tends to reflect the ethnic, gender, racial diversity of the larger population. In terms of the heredity of blindness, so the member of our advisory board with two blind children, her husband is blind, so that does happen. However, there are lots of other ways that children become blind that aren't genetic in nature, and so we expect a mix of types of families. That's why it's one reason it's really helpful to have Brad, our grad assistant, on the team who's blind, because he is able to tell us what is accessible that we create, because we expect that a lot of our materials will get into the hands of parents with visual impairments or blindness, and he's able to tell us what is okay before we send it out there.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Please. Yeah.
Tell me about acceptance and principle.
Good.
This is new to me.
Yeah. I have slides. I love talking about this because it's a development in social education, psychological science, kind of in the past 10 years. If you go to the next slide. There, okay. So maybe the one before that. There's something called registered reports that has emerged in, like I said, in social behavioral sciences in the last 10 years. And it was in reaction to this problem that we were seeing of people not clearly stating their hypotheses and the methods they were going to use before they began a research project, which would give them a little bit of wiggle room after they'd collected their data to do lots of different analyses to see what interesting things would appear, which on the one hand produced a lot of interesting things. On the other hand, those aren't really best practices for producing reproducible results. And so there is a movement in the field now to have researchers write the first half of their manuscripts, their introductions and their method sections, what we plan to do before they collect data, submit them to a journal, It goes through peer review at that point, and at that point, if the reviewers say, yes, we approve of these methods, the journal then commits to publishing the manuscript no matter what you find, which also deals with the problem of a lot of pressure to find something, because what if you can't publish your study because nothing was significant? So to me, it's just like a huge weight off knowing before we even collect data that we're going to be able to publish everything that we produce, and it's already been through a rigorous round of review, so I know I'm using the best methods. And currently there are approximately 300 journals that use this system. So in a huge range of fields, I was just meeting with a grad student last night who's studying educational psychology in the realm of nursing, and there are 4 nursing journals that accept registered reports, so that she she's thinking of doing that for her dissertation, which is also a huge relief for our students who can graduate knowing that they're going to have publications with them when they graduate.
Wow, thank you. That's completely new to me, and it's fascinating. I'm just thinking of all the ways that could advance the search for knowledge and the excitement that students would have about the research process if they could get one of these registered reports. Is there, can you register a report with a journal and publish somewhere else if your discoveries are like really amazing and
yes,
you think a better journal is fitting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's nothing to prevent you. They must publish what you give them, but you do not have to publish it with them.
Great, thank you.
Lee?
I want to echo a very impressive program and appreciate your leadership and involvement in this research. I'm curious on the area again of collaborations with other organizations. So I'm familiar with an organization out of Minneapolis, Minnesota called PACER, the Parent Advocacy Coalition for Educational Rights. The reason I'm aware is I have a nephew who is, I think he's 50 years old now, or close to 50, who is multiple handicapped, that he's mute, he's deaf, and visually impaired. And my sister got involved when he was a young child in this organization, grew up in Minneapolis. And the support for that organization, which was founded, I think, in 1977, has been significant. And they've gone nationally and now internationally. And I'm curious of the potential involvement of that scope of organizations out there. Are you familiar with opportunities to partner? Because this seems like an area that has significant promise in the research you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious what types of relationships can be established to help continue the support of this research.
Thank you. I'm not familiar with that organization. I would love to get to know them better. I would love to partner with anybody who wants to partner with me. In terms of some organizations like that in the Northern Illinois region, I've worked in the past with Second Sense in Chicago and RAMP in Rockford, which are both related to blindness or disability advocacy. And they've been supported in terms of, once again, disseminating information about our studies to their participants, but also providing space. If a participant doesn't feel comfortable or isn't able to come all the way to DeKalb or doesn't want us coming to their home, we've been able to use those places as places like neutral ground to meet to conduct our data. That I'm really open to exploring mm-hmm. all kinds of collaborations. And it's one reason that we tried to recruit an advisory board that I'm hoping will have their fingers in some of those places.
Because I think I'm also familiar that in this organization, one of the big supporters of these efforts has been the Minnesota senator who was just reelected, Amy Klobuchar. She was heavily involved with PACER because she has a child with disabilities as well. And, you know, so she is a strong advocate for programs.
Oh, that's good
that,
to know.
That, you know, and so I think there's avenues to explore here. Because, again, what you're doing here, and you mentioned that small handful of other universities are involved in this. I mean, this could be a program here at NIU that could be singled out as an extensive opportunity, in my view.
Yes, and I am happy to take further advice on connecting with these people in other states and elsewhere because, yeah.
I'm, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Interesting. Anyone else? Rita.
First of all, thank you for a really interesting presentation. And,
thank you.
On the broader, I think this is exactly what we've been talking about when it comes to research and innovation at the university. The fact that Northern is doing something like this with only a few other major universities, and it even extends beyond the partners and the communities that you're looking at. I mean, I think this is an issue and a study that a lot of people will be interested in, and you can tell just by the way the board's reacting. So in addition to, you know, the normal channels that you would go to, if there's any way to think about how we present these types of things to a broader audience, I think that would be great. I mean, I'm impressed. I think the whole board's impressed. It's exactly what we've been talking about when we talk about research and innovation. And I'm really glad you're sending us those monthly?
Quarterly.
Oh. Don't put the pressure on
them.
How about weekly?
Can you go to my very last slide?
She has a slide for that.
Absolutely.
Of course, of course.
The very last slide.
So I wanted to say that I would be happy to present my findings to a larger audience. I've actually done this a bit in the past with things I have less expertise on than this area. So. In addition to conferences, our peer-reviewed publications, I expect to, I'm happy to do media appearances. I also wanted to plug my center, CISL, that I co-direct, has a recently launched podcast that has been well-received. We've been interviewing experts coming to campus from other universities, as well as people here on campus doing interesting language and literacy-related research. So I expect to also be on that podcast sometime soon.
Thank you very much. That's exactly what I've been talking about, and I'm so impressed how you have a slide for everything.
Turns out it's really hard to get grants. You have to be very organized. So my organizational skills have come a long way.
Montel?
One more question. And forgive me, because this, I guess, the business side of me is coming out. Is there an opportunity with, I don't know if you've thought long enough through this process, is there a revenue opportunity once you get your findings to work with a private company that may be able to do creation of that, like the device you showed us? You said we're the only university in the country that has that device. Are we looking to see if there's an opportunity for revenue generation here to create an income stream for the services you might be able to provide?
I have not, but if technology transfer at the university would like to meet with me to talk about potential opportunities, I'd be open to that. At this point, it's very early days, and I'm thinking, you know, not quite that long term.
Let me ask a different way. Are there companies out here that would cling to this kind of information and use it for that purpose?
So I mentioned that we've partnered with American Printing House for the Blind. They're really excited about this research because they, in collaboration with a private for-profit tech company, created this device. And NIU has longstanding relationships with the American Printing House, which is why we have one of these devices. And they're really excited to give it to us because we're going to be able to demonstrate the practical and theoretical impact of it. So we have, in that sense, a partnership with revenue-generating institutions. I don't know how to funnel that to us necessarily.
And I'm sorry, again, what were the other universities that are involved in similar research?
I don't know if you want the names of the PIs, but they're at Rice, Johns Hopkins, and Harvard.
Harvard, yeah.
And we're happy to get Innovation to talk to you.
Great, thank you. Thanks.
John, we still have questions.
Okay.
You give this board an inch, they'll take a mile. So go for it, John.
So I wonder if you could situate yourself before you knew about the NIH R16 SURE grants and when you learned about it. How did you get there? How did you get to the funding source and begin the process of thinking, what I'm interested could fit this?
I subscribe to lots of listservs and automatically I get emails every week about new funding opportunities. And the R16 is a fairly new mechanism, so I think I may have learned about it before the SPA professionals on our campus, because I saw this show up in one of my feeds and I went to them and I said, this is what I want to do. So that's how I found that opportunity. The reason that I was able to write a competitive grant, I think, was because my College of Education had hired a consulting firm to work with faculty to improve their grants, so as you heard, I was an English teacher. I take a lot of pride in my writing, and I feel like I'm a very good writer, but there's no way that I would have written as good a grant proposal without them, because it's a very specific kind of writing, and they were able to just really dig in and show me what I needed to change. So yeah, I'm pretty confident that at least the first time around, I had a leg up because of the Hanover consultants that I worked with through the College of Ed.
I had a question. So what I was thinking of here is, I was listening to your presentation, which was great, by the way, thank you.
Thank you.
But from a language standpoint, so if it's Spanish or it's, you know, whatever, you know, some other language, how does that, do you have to just adjust everything, I'm guessing, on that? Or
so you mean in terms of the languages our participants speak?
Yeah, the language that you're...
So in order to be eligible to participate in our study, they have to speak English as their primary language.
Got it, okay.
However, their parents don't have to. So that's why we're creating all of our materials in at least English and Spanish, because we expect that a lot of the families will not necessarily be highly proficient English speakers.
Okay. So do you work? So will you be working with people in other countries on this then, you think, with other languages?
Maybe down the road. Initially, we're recruiting just in North America, U.S. and Canada.
I see the University of Tsukuba in Japan is doing a lot of work in this area.
Cool. Supposedly. What's the name? Tsukuba.
Tsukuba.
Yeah. I used to... So I left this out of my life talk, but I don't have a slide. Before I was an English teacher in New York City, I was an English teacher in Japan for 2 years, and I actually lived near Tsukuba University.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah, I'll have to look into that.
ChatGPT, though, that's great. You know?
Nice.
So, anyway, any other questions? All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Any other discussion? Actually, I have one. So you're a football fan, NIU football fan.
Yeah.
Do you know have we researched on where our offense has been the last 6 weeks?
No comment.
Okay, all right. Because, boy, did we come out last night, but we're happy to see it. Hearing no other questions or discussion, are there any other matters requiring the attention of the board today? Hearing none, the next meeting of the Research and Innovation Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee is February 20, 2025. May I have a motion to adjourn the meeting?
So moved, Gales.
Second, Marcina.
We have a motion, we have a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the question. Mrs. Wright, will you please call the roll?
Committee Vice Chair Rita Athes?
Yes.
Trustee Dennis Barcima?
Yes.
Trustee John Butler?
Yes.
Trustee Veronica Herrero? Trustee Aiden O'Brien?
Yes.
Trustee Leland Strum?
Yes.
Committee Chair Eric Wasowitz?
Yes.
Board Chair Montel Gales?
Yes.
Thank you.
The meeting is now adjourned. This concludes the Research and Innovation Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee meeting.